the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Before I forget, because it is the holiday season, we've got the new limited edition oversized Phoenix tour posters up on the merch page. They were done by the artist Gonzo, Jason Gonzalez. And when they're gone, they're gone. They're large posters. They're beautiful posters. They're hand-screened, and they were specially made for this gig, and he did a beautiful job with that. That's up there. Also, I'd like to let you know that I'm on the latest episode of Alan Alda's podcast, Clear and Vivid. Go check that out wherever you get your podcasts. It's always nice talking to Alan. First time I talked to him was in a hotel room, and he gave me and Sarah a cold, but I didn't tell him about it. But it was a doozy. It was a doozy, Alan. Nice conversations both times, but the cold I could have done without. Tim Blake Nelson is on the show today. Tim Blake Nelson, that guy, that actor. Who's that guy? That guy. He's in that new Coen Brothers movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is streaming on Netflix. He's been in other Coen Brothers movies. He was on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Is that how you, is that it? You've seen him. Great actor. And I couldn't have been more off about my assumptions about him because he's an Oklahoma guy and I'd see him in things and you make assumptions. But man, what a surprising and engaged and interesting and completely out of left field, a Jewy conversation. So you Jews, tee up. Jewness is coming. Oklahoma style. Didn't think that was around, did you? Yep. I saw Beautiful Boy last night. And as somebody who is engaged in the recovery racket and part of it and attributes it to saving my life, it was hard. It was hard to watch. It's going to be hard for anyone to watch. But if you are a recovery person, you've certainly heard the stories before. To see the story is another a whole other ball of wax. It's a very emotional and relentless film. And it really fucked me up last night. And I just, I hope that everybody knows out there, and I get a lot of emails about this all the time. There's help, man. There's help. Get help if you can. I mean, I know if you're in the grips of it, if you're being strangled from the inside by addiction, and that monster inside of you is not giving you any choices, Find a window, find a moment, a reprieve where you can push back and get some help. Just call the number. Call the number. A-A-N-A, whatever A. Call the number, talk to somebody. God damn it, it just haunted me. It's so fucking heartbreaking and horrible. Addiction is just fucking horrible. But so I've been, checking back in. I'm not feeling squirrely, but I'm feeling a little dry. I don't know if you can hear that in my voice. Feeling a little dry. It rained here, man. It rained in LA, like torrential rain. Fucking glorious. I can't tell you, man. You live out here. Obviously, the fires are awful. Did a lot of damage. And you just feel the dryness, everything. It's just, I go on hikes a couple times a week, and I feel like I'm just walking through kindling that could go up at any second. It's just the land is so parched so deeply that nothing looks alive. It's like an alien landscape. It's fucking awful. So when it rains, especially like it did the other day, just like rains so fucking hard, it's like, yes, I can almost feel the earth kind of absorbing it, like just the relief of the ground. I feel it. And it also diminishes all that dryness in the air so I can touch my cats again. There's so much fucking static electricity. I'm afraid I'm going to kill Monkey or LaFonda. They're old. I don't want to shock them to death with my finger just saying hi. But the other thing that happens out here that I can't quite ever understand is as soon as it fucking rains in Los Angeles, people become morons in their automobiles. It's like instant stupid. It's like as soon as the car gets wet, it's like, I don't understand it. I mean, maybe it's because I've lived in a lot of different weather, a lot of different places on the East Coast. I've dug my car out of snowbanks that were put there by the fucking snowplows. Is that a conspiracy? Is it? I know the roads need to be clear, but is part of that deal to keep the roads clear, to completely put a wall of snow up next to yours? If you park on the street, when I lived in Boston, New York, if it snows overnight, you wake up, there's a 6-foot wall next to your car of snow that just becomes ice. Is that the city's way of saying, like, yeah, maybe wait till spring to pull out? But here it's the same with the rain. I just don't understand it. You, like, cars are stalling in the middle of the highway. I mean, what kind of neglect, what kind of service did you neglect to when it rains hard, your car just stops working? I mean, and people just, I don't want anyone to hurt themselves. And I certainly, but come on, man, it's rain. Pace yourselves, stay the proper distance behind people. Don't go really fast and then slam on your brakes and wondering why you're sliding. Maybe the roads aren't good. I don't know what it is, but every year it's the same thing. But, you know, you ride a line, man. It's just, you ride a line in the sense of, like, who you are as a person. I've talked about this before. I used to do a fucking bit about it, for God's sake. But, like, I took off the other day. We're shooting on location. It's about 45 miles away. And I'm up at 5:15 in the morning. I'm on the road at 6 to head out to location. It's still dark out to shoot Glow. And 10 minutes out on the highway, on the 134, I hit just a wall of traffic, just a standstill. I'm just 10 minutes in. I got my tea. I'm jacked as fuck, and I'm not moving. And it's raining, and I'm not moving for a fucking hour. And there's miles of traffic. And I took my own mind into my own hands, and I disregarded the Google Maps advice. And when Google Maps gives it to you, you know, they mean it. You know, with Waze, you don't know where you're going. It's a default with them. It's sort of like, who gives a fuck? Just get him off the highway and let's give him a tour of the industrial area that he doesn't know about near his home. If Google Maps tells you to change, they're like, okay, we've processed this and we've decided it doesn't happen that often. But I'm like, no, fuck it. My baseless instincts are to stay on the highway. And I did. And I seethed and I bucked and I thrashed. And then I eventually gave up. And when I realized, oh, fuck it, there's nothing I can do. I'm going to be an hour and a half late to the shoot. I hope the whole day isn't fucked, but fuck it. I'm here. And then as it starts moving, you're like, I don't know. You know, you're relieved. And then, you know, as it starts to reveal itself, what's happened, you know, there's that moment of horror. And then there's that moment of satisfaction that something happened. And then the sort of gratitude, like, God damn, I'm glad I'm not that guy. And then the sort of concern and empathy, I hope everyone's okay. But what had happened was a semi, I guess, had jackknifed in the middle of the night and just laid itself down on its side across all four lanes of the highway. And they got one lane on the side, the shoulder open finally. And there's just a truck on its side. Like, it couldn't have been planned more perfect to fuck up traffic for 2 days. And you see that truck, and it didn't look like there was fire. Anybody was probably hurt. But that was a rough phone call for that guy. You know, call to the boss. Or maybe he's his own boss. The call to whoever he was delivering to. Ugh. But, you know, the anger sort of dissipates, the relief comes, and then you got all that free highway after that, and you're sort of like, this is the way it should be. Why does it take a semi laying itself down to make L.A. highways drivable? But I hope that guy's all right. We made it. We made our day. Had a good time the other night, actually, shooting with Allison. I like it when it's just the two of us, and we're just in it for a whole scene, and I feel like I'm doing something, and I can integrate my new tools and focus on the job of acting. It was fun. Okay, is that all right to have a little fun? I remember it was my dad's 80th birthday on the 30th. Happy birthday, Dad. I don't think he's ever listened to this podcast. Never. Seriously, I don't think my father has never listened to one of my 900, almost 1,000 podcasts. But I called him up on his 80th. Here's the fucking thing. It's like, I was going to call him. You know, 80's a big deal. Then I wake up and he'd already called. Hey, just saying hi. A lot of people are calling. So he fucked that up. So I called him like, hey, I was going to call. Happy birthday. But you kind of fucked up that, you know, me, you know, you preempted. I don't know what you did there, but you took it away from me, old man. I didn't say that. I said, happy birthday. You made it. Good for you. You feeling all right? And then he started talking about politics. And thing is, my father, you know, was a Democrat. And then he's like, he claims he switched, but he didn't really know what any of it means. And he still doesn't really. He's got, it's weird when you realize your parents or whoever you talk to, maybe people in your life, have no real sense. I'd be surprised if he knew all three branches of government. But, you know, he just picks up these buttons. You know, he's like, you know, he said he became a Republican after the Kavanaugh thing. And it's just so clear that he believes that Fox News is news and that the guy talking seems like he knows what he's talking about. So he's giving me the Fox talking points. I said, I'm not going to have this conversation with you because you have no intellectual clarity or any depth to what you're saying. You're just saying things with no, you don't have any idea what's happening. Where'd you get your information? He's like, I watch things. I watch a few different. Where'd you get it? I watch a couple different shows. Where'd you get it? Well, on Fox. He's like, yeah, probably. I'm like, all right. I just can't. I don't think we need to do this. You know, I don't think we need to do it. You know, if you're just going to regurgitate what Hannity says. He says he seems to know what he's talking about. Yeah, I mean, a lot of wrong-minded, horrible people seem to know what they're talking about. It's not hard to seem to know what you're talking about. But, you know, we got through it. Anyway, let's get into this interview because I tell you, man, I thought it was great. Tim Blake Nelson is a very impressive actor and a very interesting guy, one of the great character actors of our time right now. He's in the new Coen Brothers movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He is Buster Scruggs. He's in that first story. There are, I think, five or six stories. Tom Waits is in one. Yes, I'm trying to get everyone you want me to get on the show. I'm trying to get on the show. I'm not magic. I don't know why Albert Brooks won't come on. I don't know. Like, doesn't it look whatever? Tim Blake Nelson is here, and I had made assumptions about him, and they were all wrong. His story about his family's how they ended up in Oklahoma. He's full on Oklahoma, and you know what? I'm not going to tip any of it. I'm just going to tell you that that movie is streaming on Netflix now. And this is me in conversation with Tim Blake Nelson. I just had this a straight up black cowboy boot that I remember eventually just disintegrating. Like I wore them a lot. It was a thing. I had a Western belt that I liked. That I never took off. Black jeans. I'm losing my sense of when these things happened in my life. How old are you?
I'm 54.
Right. I'm 55. And I've been through a lot of shoes.
Yeah, I guess that's true. There's that.
But like, I really committed to them. You?
Yeah. And I always wore cowboy boots in college. And then I continued to wear them when I went to grad school. And I met my wife in grad school.
Yeah.
And she's from San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, you've got to stop with the pointy boots.
No.
It's silly. And and she said, you need to wear ropers.
Uh-huh.
And they need to have a round toe. And I came around to that way of thinking, and that's what I wear now.
Oh, so that's a round toe.
That's a round toe and a roper heel.
I have a rounded toe now and some Chelsea's.
Well, you should try Lucchese's because it's the most comfortable boot you'll ever put on your feet.
Do you get them custom made?
Well, no, I don't.
Yeah.
Now, Lucchese's, by definition, are handmade.
I get it.
And this pair I got because I was doing the first costume fitting for Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeah.
And Mary Zofries, the incredible costume designer.
Yeah.
All the Coen Brothers movies,
mm-hmm.
Said, well, what, you know, let's talk about the boots. And I said, well, just get, you know, a pair of Lucchese ropers. Those,
yeah.
That's the most accurate for this character.
Is it?
Yeah.
So they've been around that long?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she said, all right. And she got a pair.
Yeah.
And Joel looked at them and said, no, those are all wrong. They need to be white boots. with a brown tip, and they need to go with the white suit.
Uh-huh.
And so Mary allowed these to fall off the truck, and I picked them up, and now I'm wearing them.
I tell you, man, if things don't fall off the truck, I'm not sure I'd have a wardrobe. If I had not... I did a show, my show on IFC for 4 years, and I think I wore three or four shirts and maybe two pairs of pants. That's all I wore. And they got a sense of my style and wardrobed me, and I took all of it. And I'm wearing, this is one of the shirts I'm wearing now.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I would not have clothes had I not had a television show.
Yeah, that's, I did a movie years ago called Syriana.
Yeah, oh, I like that movie.
Yeah, Steve Gagan wrote and directed it.
You were a congressman.
I was a lobbyist.
A lobbyist, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, and
Jeffrey Wright was a congressman, was he not?
No, he was a lobbyist as well.
Okay, right.
And we were, he was a DA.
Okay, that's it.
Or a federal prosecutor.
Uh-huh.
And I was the fall guy, and he had a scene where he dressed me down. And I gave a speech about capitalism to him.
That's right.
But then he just sort of took me out. I was given four suits
yeah.
in that movie that were tailored by the guy who tailors the suits for the Senate.
Uh-huh.
Senators.
Yeah.
So I walked off with more value in the suits than I was paid to do the movie. I was allowed to.
Yeah. It's so nice when they let you do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I had suits from a show for years. I don't really know how to shop for myself, but I get exhausted very quickly when I go shopping.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
But eventually my wife just said, it's got to end, the being dressed. You're not your characters. You're you, and it has to stop.
Was that a challenge for you to identify what exactly that meant? Do you trust your taste?
I trust my wife's taste, I just, a lot of being a husband is, and trying to sustain that is about being the best version.
That she wants you to
yes,
be?
Yes, yes. with always being true to yourself.
Sure.
It has worked out just fine.
Uh-huh. And let's talk about that. I watched Buster Scruggs a few days ago, so it's fresh in my head. As are a few of your roles, but that movie is stunning and relentless in the way that, like, there are five chapters or six?
Six
chapters, basically existential meditations and lessons that are not bleak, but they don't end happily.
They don't. it definitely, you definitely know that Ethan Coen studied philosophy and that he read a lot of Schopenhauer.
Yeah.
And also that Joel and Ethan are steeped in the Old Testament.
That's right. And what is Schopenhauer known for?
The shorthand of it is that life is nasty, brutish and short. He had the thesis in The Will to Live that even what most recommends life, stuff like happiness and particularly love, is all just a dupe to try to get us to perpetuate the species.
Uh-huh.
Because why else, without love, why would we want to perpetuate misery? And so even love
is a dupe. Yeah. I never know which philosophers to read. I was trying to plow through Spinoza, but maybe Schopenhauer is more up my alley.
Yeah. Spinoza is a lawnsman, though. So,
yeah, that's right. Absolutely. You know, that's one of the reasons you gravitate towards him. He's part of the tribe, and he's got a sort of elaborate dialogue with God.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, the stories are definitely bleak, but I think there's a tenderness.
No, they're beautiful. I mean, everything is poetry with those guys, and I don't know, how they work, but you open the movie, you're the namesake of the film, And what I liked about your story was that you're very affable, likable, sympathetic. You sing, you dress nice, and then out of nowhere, you're like, holy fuck, that guy can do that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the Coens. Yeah. I mean, I think that they if you look across their whole filmography, I think that they are always pointing out that as soon as an audience, or in particular and most interestingly and intriguingly, a character feels like he or she has it all figured out, there's going to be calamity.
That's right. They've been doing that since the beginning.
They have.
Right, where you're just sort of like, oh, now what happens?
Yeah. And I think that that's part of their Old Testament ethos, because one of the reasons that the Jewish religion is so centered on law and ritual and tradition and the interpretation of text is that life is chaotic. It's completely unpredictable. It's tragic. It's futile to try and control it. But but you do your best.
Yeah. I used to do a joke in my act about in Christianity, the saying is, what is it? The wages of sin is death. And in Judaism, the wages of sin are negotiable. you know, you just have to have an active conversation with the Almighty. It seems like there's a constant conversation going in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
But with not necessarily explanation, but there's a conversation.
Yes, exactly. He's a pretty vengeful patriarch, Hashem.
Vengeful and also just, you know, impulsive. I don't, you know, when I was just talking about Job the other day, because I have a friend who is Job-like. It's just sort of like that came out of nowhere for that guy.
Yeah.
So if my understanding of it is correct, it's just sort of like, what did I do? Nothing, you know, just I'm bored, you know, like God just decided.
Yeah. And you kind of in the end get the impression, just like with the Pharaoh, it's yeah. All right. Sure. You want to give in, but now I'm going to harden your heart. So you're not going to give in. And so there are going to be more plagues. Yeah. And I think with Job, it's as much so that he can be an example and be written about.
Yeah. Yeah. He was using him as a protagonist. He's like, I need a story. You're going to take the hit.
Yes.
Did you study religion, or is it a prerequisite when you do a Coen Brothers movie that you get up to snuff on the Old Testament and philosophy?
Well, growing up, I was bar mitzvahed at a very conservative temple in Tulsa.
Like, okay, so there for me, like this is all new information. I did a little bit of research. I don't do a lot, and I had no idea that you were a Jew. I had no idea that I was a Jew in Albuquerque, but I certainly thought like, well, I didn't place a Jewish community in Tulsa in my mind. I thought that I know that we've spread out. But I had no idea. Like, I knew the Jews in El Paso. I knew the Jews in Houston. We used to do USY together. But I didn't know the Jews in Oklahoma.
We were there.
How many, really?
The community in Tulsa when I was growing up was about 10,000.
Now, let's go back now. So how do Jews get to Tulsa?
Interestingly enough, if you've been, as I know you are, because you're who you are and do what you do, you read the news. And so you know what Hias is. Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
And they've been in the news lately because they've been under siege by the far right.
And part of the horrible massacre in Pittsburgh was aimed at them.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly right. And so what Hias used to be, and there's something very different now, which is also quite intriguing, but they used to help Jewish immigrants, exclusively Jewish immigrants, pretty much exclusively Jewish immigrants coming into this country, help them settle. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they did was when there were unaffiliated families coming in to New York City.
What's unaffiliated mean?
They had no affiliation.
Oh, in the country.
Yeah, in the
right.
country.
Okay.
So they were just coming to the U.S. with no antecedent relatives. And they would spread them out into the country. Mm-hmm. They would say, look, you're going to go to Cincinnati. You're going to go to Tulsa. You're going to go to El Paso. And the reason for this was so that they would be less vulnerable to roundups, because they figured if they didn't do that, the Jews would congregate in the cities.
So the idea was, look, it's going to happen again.
Yes.
It always happens. So this is the diaspora. Is that what you would call it?
Yes.
The American diaspora is that we're going to be logical about this if we're going to survive.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my mother and her parents emigrated out of Europe, immigrated into the U.S., their sponsors had been placed in Tulsa by Hias.
Interesting. So did they, were they running from where they were from, or did they just decide to come here?
My mother and her parents?
Yeah.
Holocaust refugees.
Refugees. So they
not were, survivors, but refugees. Yeah, running from, displaced because of
the
Holocaust.
So they got out before.
Right before Kristallnacht. And then they got to London.
And now, were you old enough to know your grandparents?
Very well, yeah. My maternal grandmother and grandfather have had tremendous influence over me.
And did you talk to them about leaving Germany or wherever they were?
Endlessly. Yeah.
Where were they?
A lot of it. In the end, they were in Rostock.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandfather, his name was Hermann Kaiser. He
from Kaiser Permanente?
No.
Another Kaiser?
No, another Kaiser.
Mm-hmm.
And not from the Kaiser Family Foundation either.
But another, what business was he in?
Oil business, eventually.
Oil in Oklahoma. That was a good business,
yes,
I'd imagine,
very good
when
business.
He got into that business.
He did very well.
Yeah.
But he was a lawyer in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, at the time of the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, he was allowed to continue practicing, even though the Nuremberg Laws did disbar all Jewish lawyers. And it just so happened that he was representing the German government in a case involving Sergei Eisenstein, the Russian filmmaker.
The film, yeah, Potemkin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he continued to practice, but then once that case was over, he was disbarred. And so they moved, he and his wife, my grandmother, moved to Rostock, where her father had, he made orthopedic shoes and brushes in a factory called Emsa Works in Rostock,
yeah,
which is a part of the former East Germany. And then they got out right before Kristallnacht and went to England. And then from England during the war, they came to the U.S.
When you talk to them, like, you know, sadly, as a Jew myself, I'm not sad to be a Jew, but you know, you ask these questions, and I asked them very quickly upon the incoming administration a couple of years ago. It's like, will we know when to go? Did you ever talk to them about that?
I did. And my grandfather, who was politically very conservative and who was staunchly pro-American and very grateful of this country, essentially said, I don't want to hear from anti-Semitism from you. You have no idea. And it's not going to happen in this country. It doesn't happen in this country. We're fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. And I have to say that growing up in Tulsa, and I don't know what your experience was.
In New Mexico.
But I never encountered anti-Semitism in Tulsa, except very infrequently if there was somebody who came in from either Chicago, there was a kid from Chicago who moved to Tulsa, or a kid from New York. But it was always somebody coming into Tulsa who moved there. And I'd hear this and that but nothing really that serious.
Nothing attacking. There was no sort of, you know, you never felt a movement.
Not at all. In Oklahoma, in fact, there was not only benign curiosity about what our community was up to, but I would say we were treated almost as exotic.
Yeah,
in a lovely way.
Well, I experienced, I guess it would be more slightly, it was a little worse than benign. It was oddly, I think, the first time that I ever experienced it was at camp, and I think it might have been a kid from Oklahoma or someplace more cowboy-ish, but he had never seen a Jew before. Mm-hmm. So there were questions.
Right.
Like literally those horrible sort of like you don't have horns type of questions.
Oh, well, that's not good.
So, he was brought up with something. And I think he was pleasantly surprised that I was just an annoying kid.
There is a friend of mine who was overheard this at a wedding in Texas. There were some Jews at the end of the table and at a wedding.
Yeah.
And he overheard a woman saying, who are they? And then the other person said, they're them that killed our Lord.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, if he doesn't die, they don't have much of a story.
See, there you go. Back full circle.
Yeah. But so how many siblings you got?
I have a sister and two brothers.
Older?
But all older, yes.
Oh, you're the youngest.
Yeah.
So now, okay, so your grandfather was in the oil business. That's a pretty rough business. So the guy, what do they call wildcatters?
Or, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So was your old man in the oil business as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. What was
and
his role?
And he got into it. Well, he worked for my grandfather for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And because my grandfather's son, blood son, my uncle was also in the company, my father thought, well, I'm never going to be able to take this company over because, of course, it's going to be passed on to his son, and that's as it should be. And so he learned the business from his father-in-law and then eventually split off and formed a company of his own.
Oil company.
Yeah.
See, this is one of those things where, like, I remember when I was, like there's some, it's not romanticization, but, like, I worked in a deli when I was younger. I grew up in New Mexico, right? But I was, my family's from Jersey, so I had a weird kind of desire to be an old Jewish man all my life. And when I was in college one year, I worked in a Jewish deli in Boston, and I was always fascinated that, you know, that I met this whole generation of older Jews who were plumbers, cops, firemen, you know, like, and I was like, oh my God, Jews do these jobs? Because there's so many stereotypes. Like, Jews don't know tools. Of course they know tools. We had to learn how to do everything just to get by, right?
Yes, exactly.
So it was always fascinating, but I've never heard of oil Jews, and this is the first, so I'm excited. You come from oil Jews.
Yeah, well, oil and gas, I would
oil
say.
Oil and gas Jews.
Natural gas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what, did any of your siblings end up in the racket?
My brother, Randy,
yeah.
Took over my father's company.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, and are your folks still around?
Yes. My father lives in Connecticut, and my mother is still in Tulsa.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She stayed there?
Yes. Yeah. She went to school in the East, and then eventually went back to Tulsa.
So she grew, like, she's full Oklahoman. They both are, right?
Well, my mother was born in England, raised for the first 4 years of her life in Germany.
Oh, before they came over here.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So she was born in England. Then she and my grandmother went and grandfather went back to Germany because they had her in England to help them get out.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was very, very schooled in history and very schooled in politics.
The lawyer.
Yeah, and he understood that this was not going to be a good place for Jews. And
Germany.
So, yeah. After 32, 33, he knew.
So he wasn't part of the crew of Jews that were like, we can work with this Hitler.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah. there were some.
Yes, I know.
Mm-hmm.
So
they had her.
And then, so they had her in England. They went back.
Yeah.
And then my grandfather left first. And my grandmother tried to stay with my mother. And he eventually wrote a telegram that said, either send the kid or both of you come.
Yeah. He knew.
Yeah.
It's time to go.
Yeah. And so then they finally got out, and then they were in England for a couple of years and then crossed the Atlantic.
So did you marry a Jew?
I married a Mexican-American Catholic.
Oh, my dad ended up with a Mexican-American Catholic. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's great. But she converted.
Really?
She converted, and it's interesting. And she's now, as often can be the case,
more Jewish than you are.
Yeah, she's zealous about it in a great way. And I made this movie called The Gray Zone years ago, which really shook my faith to a pretty profound degree.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, it's a Holocaust film, and it's about the Sonderkommandos, who were Jews in the camps who were forced or coerced into, depending on how you want to look at it, or the particular situation, into aiding in the extermination process in exchange for privileges and,
sure,
most importantly, extended life in the camp.
Mm. So a light, fun film.
Yeah. And my research into that, and which was thousands and thousands of pages, and particularly reading Primo Levi.
Oh, the Surviving Auschwitz?
Yeah.
That's a hell of a book.
Yeah. And The Drowned and the Saved also. And there's a chapter in there from which the movie borrows its title, The Gray Zone. It really shook my faith.
What about it? Like, were you, your faith in the sense that, you know, in what being Jewish meant, or your personal faith in God, or just in humanity?
In God. There's the classic Levy line, if there is a God, there could be no Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And the converse of that is the answer furnished by one's faith, which is Auschwitz is why there's a God, by way of finding some meaning for our suffering.
Hmm.
But I tend toward the former.
Yeah, still.
Not the latter. Yeah. Although I went from being an atheist to the wimpier position of being an agnostic.
Right, you're hedging your bets.
Yeah, there was a thinker.
Why draw lines when we can stay in the wiggle room of maybe?
I think, though, yes, that's probably really it. But I think the more I learn, the more I learn what's possible. And so, how could I say that it's impossible that there be a God? I think more the question is, what would
Jesus
constitute
do?
God?
Yeah, yeah.
What would Jesus do?
It's the easier path.
Yeah.
No, what would constitute God? Right. Yeah.
I think that's the better question. It's certainly not in, he did not make man in his own image. That,
no,
I don't think happened.
No, he could have done much better. That,
yeah.
So you were not brought up in Tulsa Orthodox, but just, you know, conservative and
yeah, pretty serious religious education in a sense, but I don't know if what your experience was, but mostly it involved learning to read Hebrew.
Yeah, right. You go to Hebrew school, I think, like, you know, Wednesdays and Sundays, and then when it came to, you know, prep time, you met with the cantor. You know, you learned the alphabet, you learned how to read Hebrew, you didn't know necessarily how to translate Hebrew, you knew some key words. It depends, I guess, what kind of student you were. But you, when it came to crunch time, you know, you sat with the cantor, you learned your Haftorah, you learned the songs, you did the show, and then you go to confirmation, but I bailed.
Oh, you did?
I didn't get confirmed. I did the bar mitzvah and I was out.
We didn't have confirmation because that was construed as being too conspicuously Catholic in the terminology.
Oh.
But right in the couple of years before being bar mitzvahed, we were at the synagogue 6 days a week.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
After school.
After school, 4 days a week, and then we would go to Shabbos services on Saturday with our mother, and then we went to Sunday school.
So that was for real. I mean, you were doing it. You were locked in.
But I didn't understand Hebrew. I just could read it.
Right.
And so subsequently, actually after college, I thought, well, this is ludicrous. I've never read the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read it.
In Hebrew. So you still don't know what it meant.
Exactly, which is the way to read the Bible. And then I've read a lot of the New Testament as well now. So ipso post facto, or post facto, I started really to learn about the faith.
Your siblings religious? Did they get more religious or less religious? Or does anybody go full bore?
No, not really. My sister would be the closest, but she's, I think she had her kids bat and bar mitzvah.
What were some of the, now this is like, we should get into arts in a minute, but like what, like in Tulsa, because like Tulsa, you know, that's rodeo town, that's rodeo country. It's serious cowboy country, really, Oklahoma.
Yes.
And indigenous people country.
Yes.
In a big way. So what were some of, I'd like to know some Oklahoman Jewish dishes.
Well, my wife likes to say, yeah, Tim, you come from Tulsa, Oklahoma. You come from the Upper West Side of Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, I have to say, people think about Oklahoma as ranching and cattle country, and you can get a good steak in Oklahoma.
Sure.
And that's absolutely true. But the best steakhouses in Oklahoma are Lebanese steakhouses.
Now or always?
They were when I was growing up.
But what about like Jewish food in the house? Was there any hybrids of like sort of something unique? Because like everyone has their own take on that stuff. Like on holidays, was it the standard stuff? Kugel, brisket, that kind of stuff?
No, I mean, that's funny. We never had, I think it was funny, we never had turkey on Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh.
Because my grandmother, and my mother, they would serve either goose,
mm-hmm,
or duck.
So it's like aristocratic German stuff.
It was aristocratic German stuff. That's exactly right.
Huh.
And it felt, again, I'll use the word, wonderfully exotic.
And that is exotic.
It was great to feel different in Oklahoma.
I bet. And also different as Jews, because like I had to learn, you know, there's a whole aristocratic German Jews are a whole other ball of wax, dude, from the sort of run-of-the-mill Ashkenazi Russian Polish peasant Jewish stock. That there's a whole class of Jews that were primarily German, aristocratic German Jews, who looked at those other Jews, you know, as sort of ghetto people.
That is completely accurate,
and yeah.
And I am, I come from that, half from that stock. But my mother married a Russian Jewish.
There you go.
But the German Jews were all from the Pale of Settlement as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're all Ashkenazi.
No, I get that. But something like something happened in Germany that elevated many of them in business and everything else. And
yeah, that's assimilation.
That's why they were such a threat, I guess, to Hitler, is that they ran everything.
Well, you know, yeah.
Manufacturing, the legal profession, like, right? Like, there was they had a stronghold because, I guess, this is the other thing, and this is getting not abstract, but, you know, relevant in that this idea of, you know, in anti-Semitic American language now, that there's some sort of entitlement that Jews get. It's just that Jews, out of necessity, had to put a premium on education and figuring out how to fit into structures that were inherently against them in order to succeed. So, you know, this idea that Jews have somehow gotten an easy ride, it drives me nuts.
Yeah, or, I mean, I see Philip Roth on the shelf in back of you.
Great.
And one of my favorite writers as well. There's a beautiful monologue it's a searing monologue in one of his books about how Jews got into the business of money.
Yeah.
Which
in the Middle Ages, or the Middle Ages, Renaissance, or Middle Ages?
The Christians weren't allowed to handle money, and so it was something that the Jews could do.
Yeah, their religion wouldn't let them, and it was a way to wedge their way into having a life. Well, okay, so this is a guy. Are you nervous?
Am I nervous?
As a Jew right now?
No. Okay. Well, actually, that's not true. I think if I were to go to shul,
mm-hmm.
I would be nervous.
Oh, just like because of right,
yeah.
Security.
So I think
security.
Places where Jews congregate,
mm-hmm.
and I also happen to live in New York City, which until very recently had more Jews
yeah.
than Israel.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I'm nervous because I do know that fanatics want to kill Jews.
Right.
But fanatics want to kill Christians too.
Yeah, and some fanatics just want to kill anybody.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're not really focused in their fanaticism. It's just a mental illness.
Yes.
So where does so you're growing up there on the in the Upper West Side of Tulsa. Did you have experience with I don't know why, you know, just cuz you're in a Western right now, but because the sort of struggle for indigenous people in Oklahoma must have been something on the radar,
yes,
for you growing
that's
up.
That's manifest, yeah. It was, I think, more manifest when I was growing up. I see less Native Americans
yeah.
around Tulsa. For some reason, I don't quite know why, but when I visit, than I used to.
Right.
But yeah, certainly one saw that.
Yeah.
But I think what I've experienced when I've been in New Mexico is actually more integration than I have experienced in Oklahoma.
With Native Americans?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I see more of that really in New Mexico, where the architecture, the cuisine,
yeah.
and the look of the people
mm-hmm.
is so inflected with that combination of Mesoamerica and Spain.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Than it is in Tulsa.
Sure.
Because Tulsa was a place, or Oklahoma was a place where Native Americans were relocated.
Right,
they
okay.
were not indigenous to the place.
Oh, right, so that was where they put them.
Yes, as opposed to New Mexico and to a certain extent Arizona.
Sure, Navajo Nation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now my children have Native American blood because my wife is Mexican American, and that's again that exact mix of Spain
yeah.
and Native
yeah.
Native Indian.
So how does it, like, you know, this is all I think fascinating for me, cuz like I had no idea anything about you, and now that we have this interesting Jewish story going. But how does it start that you become involved with acting?
Well, I enjoyed doing it in high school.
Yeah.
And particularly also in junior high.
But, yeah.
And then I went off to college.
Where'd you go to college?
Brown University.
Oh, Brown. Hmm.
And I was a classics major in college, and I figured I was gonna do like Paul said to the Corinthians and put away childish things. And
what
I was
were you gonna
gonna
do be a professor?
Yeah, be a professor.
Brown's a good school. I just know a lot of people. It's sort of the Ivy Leagues. It's the arty one.
That's the way to describe it.
My buddy Sam Lipsight went there. Great writer.
Oh, the writer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just saw him in New York, and you know, I think he's younger than us. But yeah, he went there, and he was there with a whole crew of rock and roll children, and you know like celebrity.
Yeah,
there's a big celebrity children presence when he was there.
Yeah, when I was there, Amy Carter was just coming in.
Sure, there you go.
And Walter Mondale's kid was mm-hmm. there, and John Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's son. May he rest in peace. So it was a lot of political left-wing
uh-huh.
politicians.
And you're doing the classics thing. So are you reading Latin and stuff?
Latin, yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
No Greek, just Latin.
So you can. Yeah. How's your Latin? Good?
Yeah, it's rusty.
Yeah. Better than Hebrew?
Yeah, it's much better than the Hebrew. Yeah. And then a lot of Greek philosophy also.
Uh-huh.
There was a teacher I had there named Martha Nussbaum.
Uh-huh.
And she was a great influence over me. I took a bunch of courses with her, and then a lot of Latin courses, Roman history. And yeah. My mother came to visit me during during my freshman year
mm-hmm.
in the spring, and she said, "What are you going to do this summer?" And I said, I'm going to come back to Tulsa and get a job and hang out. And she said, well, okay, that's great. I'd love to have you home. And she had been divorced a few years before. And so she, I think, really liked the idea of
and everyone's older
home.
Than you.
Yeah.
You're the youngest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so she said, but what do you want to do with your life?
No.
And I said, I think I want to be a professor or maybe an archaeologist. And she said, that would be great. Nothing would make me happier than to have a son who's a professor or an archaeologist and devotes his life to letters.
Archaeologist.
Yeah. And like an ancient civilization.
So you were compelled to dig up the past.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, you know, I'd love for you to come home and I'd love to see you become a classicist, but you don't even have a girlfriend right now. So you're totally unaffiliated and you have no responsibilities.
Yeah.
You liked acting in high school.
Yeah.
Now is the time when you can just try anything.
Oh, that was nice.
So why don't you go get on with the summer theater this summer and see if that doesn't still interest you or do something. But why play it safe and come home?
It's so funny that like playing it safe, like what, be a classicist or an archaeologist? Those are good secure positions. You know, like, yeah. But it was interesting. Now looking back on that conversation, do you think that she was just being nice about those things and she saw that your passion was elsewhere?
I think she was being wise. Mm-hmm. And giving me an incredible gift, one of many incredible gifts that she gave to my siblings and me. So I went and was involved with the summer theater that
in Oklahoma?
No, in Pennsylvania.
Which one? How'd that
it was
go?
It was a summer theater shared between Swarthmore, Haverford, and Bryn Mawr.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had gone to Bryn Mawr, so uh-huh. She knew of this this theater.
Okay.
And so I had a great time.
What were you doing?
I did Real Inspector Hound by Tom Stoppard. We did Hay Fever by Noel Coward, and we did a Lanford Wilson play called Fifth of July.
And were you like...
I was acting.
Small parts or
no, nice parts, and it was a sort of a collective that it was a student run theater.
Oh, so it was all young people.
All young people. We lived together in a house.
Right.
I got a girlfriend that summer.
Oh.
It just everything about it was great.
And everybody's doing the painting and the building, and yeah, everybody's.
Yes, it's exactly right.
The theater community,
hanging the lights, and,
yeah,
all
yeah.
of it.
Right. That's how it works. That's how that people would seem to have that experience in theater or start acting that way, get a real appreciation for.
Did
for,
you do it?
No, but I've talked to many people or a few certainly that their first experience was either in a Shakespearean company or a situation where you were part of it was learning the community of theater.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, though, and I was listening earlier to your podcast with Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
I was also starting to do stand-up comedy at the time.
No.
Yeah.
I could see that.
I wasn't good.
Where'd you do it?
Well, I did it in Providence.
At Periwinkle's?
That's exactly right. Yeah. At Periwinkle's. And one performance I remember that was just incredible was I saw Ricky... Not Ricky Jay. Is that right? Not the magician.
No, I know who you're talking about. Billy Jay.
Billy Jay.
Sure. I was wondering what happened to that
God,
guy.
He was funny.
Short guy. Wore
yeah.
a hat.
And screamed a lot.
Yeah.
And he had a bit about, why do we wear these metal bowls on our head? Yeah. It's because of the piddler. The piddler on the roof.
Uh-huh.
but I was terrible.
I was just wondering about him the other day because there was a period in time there where he was, he got very bitter. And most people don't know who Billy Jay is, but he was around New York. But he got cast. The thing that stuck in his craw that kind of did him in a bit, I think, was he was cast in that Dustin Hoffman movie called Billy Bathgate about the gangster movie. And he was almost entirely cut out of it. And he had very little in the movie. And I think it just killed him because he used it as a credit for years. But you had to go see the movie and he was just a passing presence. And he got very, he was an angry little man. But it's so funny. That's the guy. I love that's the memorable.
But the thing. Anger was funny.
Oh yeah, no, he was. Yeah.
And I think it. You know, and then I came out here.
But wait, let's talk about stand up. So you're doing open mics at Periwinkles.
No, and then I came out here and did stand up in L.A. for the summer.
Oh really? Where doing
Laugh Factory
open mics?
Open mics, and then I got on at the Laugh Factory. They put me on. I could come any night, and then I was just the bottom rung. So
when it was just a hallway next to the old Chinese restaurant?
Yeah, Jamie Masada ran it.
Well, he still owns it, but back then it was just like you walk in and you were in the room. Right,
yeah,
right.
That's right.
He would sit there on the right, and then there would be this long room that was like the size of a hallway in my recollection. Yep. And if you had to go to the bathroom, you had to walk all the way down the side, and there was a door on the side of the stage. It was a tiny place before he built it out, and that old Chinese restaurant was still there. Like right next door.
And Greenblatt's, down the street. Yeah. And he owned it.
Yeah.
And the guy who, the ombudsman was Falstaff.
Mm.
It's this big.
Yeah, the comic.
Yeah, comic.
Yeah, I vaguely remember him.
And he would let me on, but my God, Jamie hated it when I would go on.
Was Fraser Smith hosting?
Yeah. And Falstaff.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And they would put me on. Yeah. Usually I'd get there at around, I had a day job out in, this was the summer after my sophomore year at
so
college.
You were going for it. You thought it might be the thing.
Yes. And I just was derivative and not very good.
Of who?
And,
Woody Allen?
No, Robin Williams.
Oh,
just doing characters.
But, oh, yeah.
And I, at the end of that summer, even though I would get there at around 9. I had a day job. I was worked at the Boulangerie in this restaurant called the Boulangerie in Venice, making sandwiches during the day. And then I would get to the Laugh Factory at about 9, and I would keep getting bumped because I wasn't very good.
Yeah. Go on about 1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go on at about 1.
For 9 people.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and just wait and wait.
Welcome
and wait.
To it.
Well,
welcome to
yeah.
comedy.
And I never got past that rung. And I, at the end of the summer, I said, acting. I did stand up for a summer, and I did theater for a summer, and I'm not going to do anything to help I'm not doing anything new as a comedian. I would get to watch for 3 hours a night.
Oh yeah, and it just chip away at your confidence, and you just like you just sit there and you watch the audience leave. You watch all these big acts come on.
Yeah, but they were really good, and I thought it chipped away at my confidence. But at least for me. That wasn't the worst thing in the world, certainly not for the art of comedy. I wasn't going to end up developing, you know, like a Lou Black persona or something.
How do you know?
I guess I don't know, but I'm pretty confident.
Well, it's good that you understand the limitations of your talent, but like, you know, most of us who get into comedy, like, you know, we just plow on, you know. You know, like, I mean, it's like in my mind, you chose the more difficult path in a way.
I think stand-up comedy is the more difficult path. I actually do. I really, because I think that to stick with it, you see, I mean, there was such a grim side of life that I saw during many of those hours and hanging out. And, you know, one night.
Those are my people.
I think that's a good thing,
I'm not taking it as an insult. We're all very proud of our grim side of life.
One night I was there, and I don't remember this comic's name, but he was really, really dry and funny and cynical.
Uh-huh.
And he was a regular at the Laugh Factory. This would have been in 1984, 85, around there. Jewish guy. And,
Really? In comedy?
And it's the end of the night, and I don't know why. He had shown up really late. Maybe he'd been at a couple of other clubs and stopped by the Laugh Factory at the end. And for whatever reason, I'm not quite sure why, he was kind of still around after I did the very last 5 minutes.
Oof.
And so I'm walking out of the club, and I am walking up Laurel to my car where I'd parked it. And there's this Asian woman who's just, she is just incapacitated by alcohol. I mean, she's just stumbling
drunk. Shit-faced.
Yeah, really bad.
Yeah.
And she's trying to negotiate the key into the car door.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, well, this is not good. And I said, ma'am, may I help you? And she's sort of mumbles back at me, and again, clearly not a good situation. And I thought, well, I can't let this woman drive. I've got to wait here, and just I don't know what I'm going to do. And this is before cell phones. So then this comic comes out, and he stops, and he's studying the situation. He's not saying anything. And I turn to him and I say, we can't let her drive. And he says, well, what do you want to do? You want to roll her or you want to fuck her? And I said, neither. I want to call the police, and you know, and he
want to help her.
Yeah, I want to help her.
Yeah.
And he wasn't serious.
Right.
But it was such grim. It was such exquisitely grim. Just the darkest of the dark humor,
uh-huh.
In the context of 1:30 in the morning, and this woman, and she was actually kind of pretty, which uh-huh. made it even worse.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I'm really grateful to be exposed to these people and this world.
That's what did it. That's yeah. what simultaneously made you grateful and Get Out.
Yeah, and I thought I'm not gonna. This is not going to be good for me.
You're not going to do that to yourself.
Yeah.
You're not going to become a dark, cynical fucking monster. You had too much heart, kiddo. You realized at that moment, I'm like, oh my God, these people, there's no bottom to this. Yeah, I don't want to hurt my heart that much.
And I think that's probably true. And that's why you guys are so damn funny.
Yeah, yeah, and also, but you know, there is a line that one rides. I mean, you know, with comedy and with, you know, and certainly back then, you know, there was a kind of ethic to it that, you know, you kind of really push the envelope of what was funny and what isn't funny, and you know, how dark can you be and how dark can you get, and also there's the natural kind of evolution of forcing yourself to be funny that to the point where, as a comic, you get jaded and cynical enough that, you know, only the most dark things are funny. And I do think that if you're not compelled to callous your heart like that, I mean, I think all comics are sensitive, but they're certainly in a very complex way, very, you know, deeply well guarded.
I think that's absolutely true, and certainly true of the best of them.
Yeah.
And
they can be vulnerable, but probably, you know, on stage, just from my own personal experience, I can be vulnerable, but you know, in real life, you know, the price you pay for being vulnerable to an audience, you know, in that way, you know, it does, your personal life doesn't necessarily reflect that all the time.
Yeah. I
seem like a sweet guy.
Yeah. I hope I am.
Yeah.
But I think that comic was a sweet guy.
Sure.
I think a really, really sweet guy, and also smart as all get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very difficult to be smart and sweet at the same time.
And funny.
Yeah. That's what I admire. I mean, I don't want to switch subjects because I love what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But that's the key to Joel and Ethan. When people say that Joel and Ethan are cold as filmmakers. I want to set myself ablaze. I'm so upset because they're anything but. There's such generosity and warmth in their generous in their exposure of their take on the world.
Sure, I think that like when I've talked to people about them, I it sounds my interpretation was not so much that they were cold, but they know exactly what they want, and I think maybe to an actor that might come off as to some as confining somehow.
Well, except that they know so clearly what they want that they've prepared to an extent, and they have such control. That on the day when you're shooting, you actually never have more freedom as an actor than when you're on their set. Because there's no castigation. You can fail, and they have the time for that, and they have the patience for that. And they've given you a role, and this is whatever role you're playing in one of their movies, even if you have but a day.
Mm-hmm.
They've given you a role that is such an invitation for what I like to call front-footed acting, making a bold choice, that you just gravitate toward that kind of risk-taking. And only on a set like theirs, where everything is so under control and meticulously planned and so carefully written, can you have the space to be able to take those chances, because nobody is fretting over whether they're going to run out of time or what the next shot is going to be.
Right.
It's great.
And in terms of front-footed acting, and also in terms of this this new movie, which is Six Stories, you know, they their love of people who are able to do what you're calling front-footed acting, these sort of bold character actors, that are very specific, I find. They seem to have a true passion for.
Yeah, so many of us, so many of the great character actors, so I'll leave myself out. But if you think about John Goodman and Turturro and Francis McDormand, Holly Hunter, Steve Buscemi, Michael Spielberg, Stephen Root, Stephen Root, who had his own career before he met them.
Yeah.
But the others I'm describing
started with them.
Really did.
Yeah.
And I can say for myself, who was going to put me in a lead role? I mean, I was doing fine as an actor, working a lot off Broadway and doing what I like to call a hallway part in a movie every year, where you accompany the lead down a hallway and deliver a bit of information that he needs while he's getting from point A to point B.
I just did one of those.
Oh, good.
I literally did a hallway scene with Robert De Niro two weeks
fantastic.
Ago.
Oh, fantastic. Oh,
in the Joker movie.
Oh, wow. Oh, great.
It was literally a walk and talk down backstage in a hallway situation.
Did you like it?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
that's fantastic.
It was my first experience on a real big movie.
You'll be in a Coen Brothers movie in no time.
I would love to.
Yeah.
I don't know that I know how to do that type of character work.
Well, that's interesting. I who knows? I don't know enough about you, but I do know that they do gravitate toward actors who've had classical training.
Mm-hmm.
Because to do their language, I think there's the need for a facility with that. But then there are others who fit gorgeously into their world who don't. But in the really talkative characters.
But it's interesting that, you know, in what you're talking about, front-footed and character acting, is that in the one story where James Franco plays the lead, he's not essentially, I mean, I think he can do anything. I think he's a fine actor. But he's not innately the type of actor that Stephen Root is, or maybe even that you are in terms of your training or in terms of having a broad spectrum of character, you know, potential.
Yeah, I mean, James is more of an autodidact
right.
as an actor.
Right, so, but
he's been serious about that pursuit.
No. Yeah. I like him, but it was interesting. You can see the difference, not just between him and Stephen Root, the primary other character, but even the guys that ride up on horses are so chiseled and defined, you know, yeah. just in their presence of character, you know, against him. It's an interesting, I notice this a lot. You know, in doing Glow, too, that, you know, Betty Gilpin comes from the New York School of Theater Actresses, and Alison Brie is very much a product of Los Angeles. And I see there's different approaches, you yeah. know, and they can fit, well, they fit great together sometimes, but there's difference. There's a difference.
Yeah, you're completely right.
So where did you train?
I went to Juilliard.
Really?
Yeah.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
You did the whole
four
thing?
4 years. I went to 4 years of college and then 4 years of acting school. So I did not get out of school till I was 26.
Juilliard's hard, man.
Yeah, it's a pretty.
I mean, they're heartless and they're cutting.
Well, not so much anymore.
Oh.
But when we were there, my wife and I was in class with them. I was in the same year as Laura Linney, wonderful mm-hmm. actress.
She's great.
And Jeannie Triplehorn.
Oh yeah,
New York theater actor named David Aaron Baker. Another actor named Jake Weber. So, you know, I was in an interesting, it was a good time to be there, but it was brutal.
And so you did all of it. You did sword fighting, Alexander technique,
singing,
dancing.
Singing. Yeah. Yeah. Good speech.
Uh-huh.
We even had comedy class.
Oh, who taught that?
A guy named Harold Stone.
A miserable man?
No, he was great. But, you know, an incredible thing happened. So Robin Williams went
to... Did you do mask work?
Yes. Uh-huh. I loved mask work. That was one of my favorite classes. You know everything, man. mask work was great.
Animal work?
Yes, we did a bit of that. Yeah. Mm. First year. Mm-hmm. But Robin Williams went to Juilliard.
Yeah.
And so the guy who
They wanted him out.
Well, it was an issue, a money issue.
Uh-huh.
And so then he formed a scholarship.
Robin
gave a scholarship to Juilliard for anybody who couldn't afford to come back to and my wife got that scholarship.
Oh, yeah. Robin,
we did a movie together, Robin and I. And my wife came to visit and she was able to say thank you.
Oh,
which was a great.
He must
Great
have
moment.
Loved it. He's a sweet guy, man.
Oh.
He was a sweet guy. What movie did you do with him?
It was called The Big White. Mm. It was with Robin and Holly Hunter Giovanni Ribisi, Alison Lohman, and we were all up in Alaska together.
What were you going to say about him?
Oh, I was going to say that. So there was the teacher of the comedy course. In an admirably self-deprecating speech at the beginning of the course, said, "Look, I'm teaching this course, but I'm not going to claim to be funny. I've taught a lot of people in this course, and some of them didn't end up being particularly funny. But I did teach Robin Williams in this course.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not going to claim that he wasn't funny beforehand. All right. So then Robin Williams comes to speak to us.
Uh-huh.
And this student named Peter Jacobson in my wife's class raises a hand, and he wants to throw a softball to Robin so that Robin can praise this comedy teacher.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "How did you like the comedy class? We hear you took the comedy class." And Robin, as only Robin could do, just went on this monologue about how ridiculous it would be to try to teach comedy. And how he had never been in a comedy class. And he just went on and on and on. And it was so
Was Stone in the room?
Embarrassing. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But it was a good class. It was a great class. I loved the class.
He talks, Itzkoff in his Robin biography, he talked a lot about his time at Juilliard. It's interesting. How difficult, you know, because he was there with Chris Reeves and
yeah.
I think maybe Bill
Patty
Hurt.
Lupone.
I don't know. Was Bill Hurt there?
Yeah.
Think? Yeah. And just how, you know, strict it was.
It became progressively less strict. When my wife and I were there, it was still pretty strict. They cut a third of the class.
Mm-hmm.
About a fourth of the class. They warned a third of the class. So in your middle of the second year, you were warned we may cut you at the end of the year.
So when you get out of there, you know, what do you, you're fully prepped, you're loaded up, you got all the tools, and what was your dream to do? What were you wanting to do?
Be a stage actor.
Yeah.
And you don't have all the tools, but you have as many of the tools as a school can give you.
Right.
So I don't want to, I loved the school. I would not have wanted to have gone anywhere else. It was the perfect place for me. It was difficult. It was at times quite demeaning. And at times it was also quite nurturing and fortifying. But I think what happens after any drama school, and this is not unique to Juilliard in the least, is there's much you need to unlearn while you're internalizing it. So it just,
that makes
a
sense.
Lot of what you've learned just has to become part of your intuition as an actor, as opposed to a conscious application of technique.
Well, it's interesting that the idea of internalizing what you learned is also unlearning it, because I mean, ultimately, you know, when you're in a real life work situation, you're only going to use what works for you. And that may or may not look like what you learned or didn't learn, but you assume that it's in there.
That's exactly right. We all tailor make our strategies.
Of course. I mean, like, you know, I talk to people about acting when I started acting more, because I need to know things, you know. But, you know, so much of it, you know, depending on which level you're operating at, and there's a lot of them, you know, some people are just good at pretending. Mm-hmm. Some people just have a knack for being on screen or on stage. And then there are those people that have much more facility because of an education. But anybody's craft is sort of up to them how they're going to get into what they do.
That is, it's your own approach. It's like learning how to go to school.
But when you say front-footed, when you say bold choices, when you, because, like, you know, in the Coen movies you've done, what have you done, two?
I was supposed to do another one, and then I had to back out because of a scheduling conflict.
Which one?
No Country.
Oh, what were you gonna play in that?
I'll just say I had a role in it, and it was not Anton Chigurh, but it was another role, and it wasn't Josh Brolin's role, but it was a nice role. I couldn't do it. And thankfully they didn't take that it was a legitimate conflict.
But when you say these things, when you say these choices, like when I think about, you know, Oh Brother and the new one. So when you talk about being in a situation where you have this room because of the control they have on the set to really take these chances with the character in the ballad of the new film, what were they?
Well, I'm going to just generalize a little bit. So in American acting, we took what Stanislavski was saying in An Actor Prepares, and also in the training of the Russian theater actors.
Yeah.
And we brought it over here, and we, depending on your attitude toward this, we either contorted it or we evolved it into something that they call the method, which is the Actor's Studio, among other places.
Group theater, Actor's Studio.
And
Meisner.
And that coupled with film acting and needing to do less, for just lack of a more interesting way of putting it, because the camera is so close,
right,
began to elevate the notion of behaving over actively pursuing objectives as an actor.
Oh, okay.
So if the camera could catch you being real and behaving in a certain way, showing emotion in a natural way, that was suddenly venerated as great acting.
Right.
And so showing emotion, being real, not seeming to be deploying any sort of training in terms of how to do a line or how to play a line rhetorically.
Right, so you get that generation, you know, after Montgomery Clift, James Dean, Marlon Brando, up through De Niro, Pacino, and some other cats. Dog Day Afternoon is a great example of what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
and the ones who do it incredibly well, I mean, it's fantastic.
Right.
You feel like you're witnessing human behavior.
Uh-huh.
But there's also a tendency, as a result of that, to lose sight of what a character actually actively wants in a scene.
Yeah.
Because we do as human beings. I'm doing it right now. I'm trying to get through to you and we're engaged in a back and forth here.
It's working,
yeah.
Tim.
It's active.
Yeah.
And so what I mean by front-footed acting is that there are techniques you can use, and I learned these actually after Juilliard from this wonderful director I had named Mark Wing Davey, who now runs the graduate actor training program at NYU, where my wife now teaches, is to find an action. This is just one example.
Yeah.
Find an action for every line you have. And when you apply that action, it has to be in the form of a transitive verb. So
can you give me some examples?
Okay, so if I wanted to piss you off, I would pierce you. So I'm going to say this line, and I'm going to use it. So I would literally write that into my text, pierce him with this line. And so you do that.
Yeah.
You do that literally for every single phrase that you have in your text.
I'm actually making notes because I'm about to start, you know, shooting again. And this is the missing piece. Keep going.
And so you have all that. And then what you do is you forget it.
Yeah.
So you don't take that to the, you do that while you're working on a role.
But okay, so you get this with every line, the transitive verb in the form of action that you sublimate under the line.
Yeah.
But is there an arcing, do you think about the arc of the character's needs?
You know, when I think of the arc of a character's needs, I think there's something, you know, like if I'm in a scene and I'm playing with a woman and the character wants to have sex with her.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, that's what I want. But it all evolves and changes. It's in constant flux.
But you know that's in place when you read the scene and you're like, okay, so this guy wants to do this to this. And then you go line for line.
Yeah. And then you've got to forget it.
Yeah.
Because of course, the next and really most exciting part is that you've made all those decisions ahead of time and you've worked on that. But then you're going to play the scene with a partner and it's all going to change.
Sure.
And then it gets really, really... It gets terrifically exciting because then it's living thought.
And then right when you're completely in it, you're like, cut!
Yeah. And so that's just an example. And if you don't have that with Cohen acting, because there's such an active precision to what they've written, you're not, it's not going to work because they're not interested in you're just coming on and behaving. They write characters who have really, really strong needs and objectives.
Uh-huh.
And usually they're deploying some pretty colorful language in pursuit.
Their sort of love of the type of actor that you're talking about is so beautiful to see.
Yeah.
Right when you see the face, you know, they got a hell of a casting capacity.
They get it right. They just
it's a treat.
Get it right.
Every frame is a treat.
Yeah. They're like cartoon cells.
Yeah. Did you love working with Clooney?
Yeah. He's just really, I mean, John and George were so unbelievably kind to
George.
Me. George Clooney.
John Turturro.
And George. John Turturro on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. So kind.
Isn't that fascinating, though, about him? See, this is just me being the observer. It is that he's a fucking movie star, right? And he's a great movie star. And there's a couple of them that can do this. Like, you know, Turturro's like, you know, he'll transform. He's a, like you a bit in that, you know, he can take on, be front-footed, you know, really do a Cohen role. But George is interesting because, you know, with movie stars who just for, you know, some God-given reason just are movie stars, they fit up there. Who knows what that is?
Yeah.
But he can act. and you know, and he can make adjustments to his movie starness. You always see Clooney in there, but he can make these adjustments. He can turn a dial, and it's very effective and sort of amazing.
I couldn't agree with you more. And you've not only just defined what a movie star is, because there's the movie star always has to have that aspect of them yeah. in the role,
right?
And they've got to be responsible.
By nature.
And they've got to be responsible to that, mm-hmm. Which often inhibits movie stars from making the choices that they should be making as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
George is never guilty of that.
Right.
The Descendants.
Oh, yeah.
Up in the Air.
Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
That his performance in Burn After Reading is sort of astounding. That, you know, all these weird quirks that he decided on and the yes. running and the, you know, and Brad Pitt's another one who can do it.
Yeah. That hair and the gum chewing, all those choices.
The, the listening to the earphone. Yeah, I mean, those choices, those are the choices.
I was talking with Joel about this the other day, that Clooney's performance in Hail Caesar, when he's encountering God. Jesus at the cross, the outtakes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So funny. So funny. Even when he's sitting with the communists and he's finally getting it, where he's sort of like, no, wait. So, yeah. Oh God, that movie. See, I think that's a fucking masterpiece. No one thinks it's a bad movie, but I think it's one of their best movies. And like, I seem to be in the minority. But like, I think that if somebody, if they had a double bill that was Barton Fink and Hail Caesar, that's it. Those are their Hollywood movies.
Well, yeah, well, it's both. The both of them are set at Capitol Pictures.
Yeah, I know.
Where writer is king.
Yeah, it's. I worked with Lerner, with Charles Lerner. That's his name.
Michael Lerner. Yeah,
he was on my show. He played my mother's husband.
Oh, right.
He's a piece of work, dude. He is something else.
How about him in A Serious Man?
Great. I auditioned for that movie.
Oh, you did.
Yeah, but I wasn't. There was no way.
Did you go into the room and meet them?
No, I didn't. I've never met them. I've met Francis. I was nominated for a SAG Award for Glow,
mm-hmm.
and like I'm a big fan of hers and them, and you know, and I'm standing there, and you know, I want to interview her and stuff. But obviously, I wasn't going to win a SAG Award, but it was very like I had, you know, it's all gravy to me. I'm like, oh, great. I mean, I'm very flattered. It was a big star-studded night that I skulked away from. I didn't say anything. I always feel weird doing that. Hi, yeah, how are you? Not you on a plane. I did. You don't remember, but I was like, I'm gonna say hi to that guy.
Well, I am so glad you did follow up on the invitation. As I said to you, my son Henry, who's at Oberlin College.
He's at Oberlin?
Yeah, in the conservatory. He's
musician?
Doing classical composition and jazz composition over 5 years. He's doing 2 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's been great for my wife and me because we went to conservatory to have him in conservatory getting what we consider is a great education.
What's
there.
His instrument?
His instrument is jazz guitar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he's been playing since he was 7. One of my great joys is on this movie, I had to learn the guitar from scratch to be able to play this, to accompany myself.
And ride a horse.
And ride a horse
at the same time.
Yeah. And so my son was my teacher.
Oh, good story.
Yeah. And he was so generous and kind and thoughtful, yet exacting. And patient.
He wanted you to get it right.
Yeah. And he would just, you know, making sure that I, you gotta really press the strings, Dad, and you know, all that stuff.
But you had about 3 chords during, right?
Just maybe. 3 chords.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like G, A, and D or something.
Yeah. G, D, and yeah, I think it is A.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
And if I got that wrong, man, am I going to hear about it from him.
God damn it, Dad, one thing.
Except now that I've been on your show, there's going to be nothing I can do wrong in his eyes, because he's such a huge fan of yours.
Oh, it's great. Maybe you can show me some licks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'll just go up to Ohio, knock on the door, and say, like, yeah, I talked to your dad. He said, show me some licks. Yeah.
Now, do you travel and do comedy?
Sure.
These
I do.
Days,
yeah. I do. I was just in New York at the Beacon on Saturday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was something.
Did you like playing there?
Yeah, I make myself a little crazy before the big ones, but it was beautiful. What a great theater that is.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I've seen Waits there.
Oh yeah. And do a lot of music there.
And ZZ Top. I got Fran and Joel to go with me to see ZZ Top at the Beacon.
Uh-huh. Recently?
No, this was about 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And we're watching them, and I'm really, really into it. And sure. I think I maybe even wore my Open Road hat,
mm-hmm.
You know, the LBJ cowboy hat.
Uh-huh.
And Ethan and Trish went too, Ethan and his wife Trish. And Fran and Joel didn't last the whole time. And at a certain point, they were having a good time,
yeah.
But I think they could just take so much. Fran sure. just looked over at me, and she just said, "Tim, you are such a cracker."
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I said, it's great.
No, man, we grew up with it. I mean, yeah. I grew up in New Mexico, and man, when Tejas came out, I grew up in the Southwest. I don't know what you call Oklahoma.
Southwest.
Yeah. So, like, you know, you had I love AC/DC. I love Lynyrd Skynyrd. I'm not necessarily talking about any sort of, like, local bands here. I mean, it was mainstream rock radio, but it was rock radio. But then there was also, right. back then, you had the FM station where you'd be, you know, kind of get hip to some stuff you didn't know about. All right. Well, I think we could do this for a while, but I think we're good.
Okay. Excellent.
You
yeah,
feel good?
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Are you going to direct any movies soon? Writing, directing?
I have a play. I wrote a play about Socrates,
uh-huh.
And that's going to be done at the Public Theater next year.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. Michael Stuhlbarg is playing the lead role.
Oh, he can do anything,
yeah.
huh?
And then I have a new script I've written, and I've got to cast it. And if
Great.
I can get somebody to play the couple of leads, I'll be making that next year. I'm doing this show, Watchmen, right now as an actor. And that'll go right into Socrates rehearsals. And then when I'm done with that, I might direct another movie.
I noticed you did two Franco's Faulkner movies.
I've done 8 movies with James.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love him. He's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I talked to him. He's great. Yeah. He's a movie star. He's a movie
yeah.
star.
He is.
Yeah. He can really, you know, he's got a way about him. Well, it's great talking to you, man.
All right.
And I hope this makes your son happy.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a doozy, right? Huh? Oklahoma Oil Juice. Wow. I loved it. Good guy. And we after the interview, he FaceTimed his son, who's a guitar player and a fan of the show. And he introduced me to his son on FaceTime, and his son played some guitar for me, and we talked a little bit. It was a nice little moment between the three of us. Technology, folks. So let's play some guitar. Boomer lives.